Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:30 on Friday, February 25th. Present, we have Representative Miller, Representative Holmes, Representative Sadler, Representative Thompson, and myself, Chair Olson. Please turn off your cell phones or Blackberries. We have four bills on the calendar today. The first one is House Bill 125, Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. We have closed out public testimony. We are down to several fiscal notes. I think we've got four of them in the last few minutes, but we're going to take the two most recent ones, I think. And we have Sue Stancliffe from the Department of Public Safety to walk us through the final version of your fiscal note, if you could, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, Department of Public Safety. The committee chair had asked for a letter explaining the disparities between the two fiscal notes that we have. For the Department of Public Safety, ours is very simple. The ABC board moves out of public safety. The money, because it is agency receipts, goes with the department. So it's there is no carryover, no administrative costs, anything to the Department of Public Safety. It all goes over to the Department of Commerce. So ours essentially is just removing it out of our budget. You had asked for this in writing. We provided it to the committee. I assume that the committee members have it, but for the record, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to read this into the record.
Certainly, if
that would be beneficial, please. As you all probably know, the Division of Legislative Finance is automating the fiscal note process this year to provide improved error checking on initial fiscal note submission. Legislative Finance is working with the Governor's Legislative Office and OMB on this process. The initial fiscal note submitted by the Department of Public Safety dated 2-8-11 showed an appropriation required in FY12 as $429.8, that's $429,000, and showed an increase of $74,700 in FY13 through 17. Although those were the amounts shown on the expenditures and revenues section in the fiscal note, the analysis explained that those were costs that the ABC board expected to incur if they are to relocate to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. As noted in the analysis, the bulk of that increase was based on an estimate provided by DCCED, Department of Commerce. There was no increase of any kind that would have gone to Department of Public Safety in any circumstances. We prepared the fiscal note based on advice from OMB about the proper form of the fiscal note. In particular, it was OMB's understanding that for the new fiscal note process, both DPS and DCCED fiscal notes needed to reflect the increased cost, even though only DCCED would have actually had the request for additional funding. After that fiscal note was submitted, the Director for Admin Services had contacted Ledge Finance legislative fiscal analysts and questioned why DPS would have a fiscal note, a positive fiscal note, when we should have simply had a negative fiscal note reflecting the ABC board leaving DPS. In ensuing conversations between all parties, it was determined that there had been a misunderstanding of how DPS fiscal note should have been shown. DPS then submitted a corrected fiscal note dated 2-15, which you folks, I believe, have in your packet, and that is the one that we stand by today, which accurately reflects the impact of DPS, of the impact to DPS if HB 125 passes in its current form, namely that all costs and staff associated with the ABC board will be transferred from DPS to DCCED. So far in the fiscal note now reflects there is a negative fiscal impact to DPS because those costs will no longer be reflected in the department budget. We apologize for any confusion that may have resulted from this process. It is our understanding that that staff at OMB has discussed the situation with Representative Hawker. We're not able, of course, to discuss Commerce's fiscal note that Joellen will address that, and I hope that this alleviates concerns over the public safety fiscal note and explains that accurately.
Any questions for Ms. Danclip? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Joellen, welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation and walk us through your most recent fiscal note.
Good afternoon. I'm Joellen Hanrahan, Director of Admin Services for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I want to echo Sue's apology for confusion. It's been a confusing process in our fiscal note process this year overall with new systems, new processes, new people, and much shorter timelines that we were all trying to work under to get these. Having said that, I would like to address the latest fiscal notes that have come in. I think those are probably the ones that are most concerned because they are showing a bit of an increase on the DCCED side. And so in response to the letter that we did provide a written explanation of the fiscal notes, and so I want to clarify that the fiscal note does, on DPS's side, show a negative for the amount that's in the FY12 governor's budget, and on the DCCED side, it would show a positive amount for moving ABC board to commerce. In addition to that, the DCCED fiscal note also includes an increased cost of $247,500. This cost is related to a one-time information technology cost for moving both the licensing system and the written record systems, there are two databases, over to commerce, and then it includes a piece of ongoing cost that will cover the associated costs for administrative support in commerce, and I'll explain both of those items. The increase in the information technology, which is the bulk of the cost and it's a one-time cost, really was arrived at through discussion with the DCCED and DPS technical teams to try to get an understanding of whether we would have any issues bringing over databases and plopping them into our environment. Through that process, it's been being refined throughout the past couple of weeks. It has been determined that there will be issues in bringing those over, partly because DPS operates in an environment that's very different from DCCED's. They're behind their own firewall that essentially isolates them from the state, and also partly because they use an Active Directory system that is also not integrated into the state. So any database systems are hardware and software sensitive, and they are configured to work in the underpinnings underneath them in the support environment that they exist within. So kind of an analogy to that would be if you have a 15-story building and you want to take out the seventh floor and move it to another building. Everything on that seventh floor is dependent upon the wiring, the plumbing, everything that's within the walls, the support system and foundation underneath that. So when you move to a new building, you have to make sure that all your equipment and everything is configured to work with the new wiring, the new plumbing, and all the support foundations that are underneath it. Our support foundations are different between the Division of Public Safety and Department of Commerce. Continuing that analogy, if we were moving the ninth floor, so the seventh floor up to the ninth floor in the same building, we would be existing within the same underlying support system. So if this had been moving from another agency, which is already on and integrated into the statewide security system and behind the state firewall, there would be less of a cost to integrate them into our system. Are there any questions on that particular information technology piece?
Nope. Please continue.
Okay. The other cost in here that is also one time, it would be to replace some of the equipment that the applications are now using in DPS and are actually equipment that's integrated into DPS's system. That equipment won't be moving over with those applications. The other cost, which is an ongoing cost, is to cover the cost for administrative support. In the Department of Commerce, our Commissioner's Office and Admin Services are primarily interagency funded. We have an approved cost allocation plan that is based on both weighted positions and efforts. And this plan allocates the administrative services and commissioner's costs out to the agencies. That is how we're funded. In DPS, public safety, they are primarily general funded, which means they don't have to allocate a lot of their costs out to their agencies. They do allocate a small portion out, and their portion allocated out is based on sort of general fund budget cuts that have occurred in the past. But they are primarily general funded, so they're not in the same position of needing to be funded by the agencies that they're serving. And so the smaller piece in here that would be ongoing is to cover that allocation cost for items that are related to fiscal, for budget, for information technology, for procurement, and for human resource assistance that they receive and statewide support that they receive from the agencies. Elements from, you know, specific in the accounting field would be deposits, refunds, credit card and revenue reconciliation, certification of auto pays and bill payments, and travel processing. Those are just examples of something, the types of services that are provided through the admin services.
Any questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, not that I'm going to be pretending to understand the IT ramifications, but wouldn't there be some automation or systematizing in the out years of the amount of money for the auto pays and the transactions? Wouldn't that decrease? Why does it never decrease, I guess?
Well, through the chair, Representative Sadler, we base the cost allocation plan on it will be adjusted over the years. The cost allocation plan gets adjusted every couple of years based on changes in an organization and based on changes in level of effort. So this is based on the existing plan of that would be for FY12. The level of effort that's going to be dealt with this agency from an accounting, a procurement, a human resource, and likely once we get it in there from an information technology, will be pretty stable over the years.
Thanks again.
Okay. And again, thank you for your patience with fiscal note development and process.
I just want to check with the sponsor of the bill to see if he has any fiscal notes that he brought with him for today.
Comments, but no notes, sir.
Thanks again. We do have the sponsor of the bill present, and we do have Shirley Gifford also in the room for questions when we get a little further into it. But I think at this point in time, we have an amendment that was passed out a couple weeks ago, and I would entertain a motion on that amendment if there is one.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I would, Representative Thomas and I have prepared an amendment. I guess I'll call it Amendment 1. I move Amendment 1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay.
Would you mind walking us through it?
Well, best I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we look on Amendment 1, which is 27-L7038/M.2, the reason for the first section of this amendment is to change the title to allow for the second section. And the issue is that there's been some, actually my district, I had heard communication from managers of facilities, service clubs, patriotic organizations that had received a request from Commissioner Gifford, Director Gifford, pardon me, to get identification cards or membership cards, key cards that would allow them to access their premises. And after discussion with the people of the clubs, decided that they shouldn't have to do that, and that this amendment removes that, makes it clear that the club should not have to provide such cards. And actually, Yeah, that's about it.
Card, key card, metal, because you're locked.
And actually, is it appropriate time to make that fifth amendment? Or?
Yeah, I hear a conceptual amendment coming.
Yes, there's a conceptual amendment, which has come up since we introduced this written amendment. Because some facilities still use old-fashioned metal keys, we wanted to inject on line 18 of this amendment, after the words of, authorized use of, insert the word metal keys, comma, and then after the word magnetic card keys, comma, such that it will now read, unless authorized by a search warrant described in AS 1235010, 1235120, nothing in this section authorizes use of metal keys, comma, magnetic card keys, comma, and then proceeds to the end.
Is there any objection to the conceptual amendment? That brings the whole amendment. I'll look my objection to the to amendment number one. Is there any further objection? The amendment as amended conceptually is adopted. That brings the amended bill back to the committee for discussion. And again, we have the sponsor of the bill for questions, and we have Director Gifford, if there are any from the committee. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, open for a motion.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 12527-LS0378-M as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves out of committee and on to Finance Committee. And a brief at ease. We're back on the record. The second bill today is House Bill 147, a Labor and Commerce Bill, and Board of Public Accountancy. Presenting the bill will be Jennifer Sinnett from my office. I'm going to think of it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, Jennifer Sinnett, staff to the chair, Rep. Olson. The bill you have before you right now, House Bill 147, an act setting the monthly salary for the Executive Secretary of the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy. As you flip through the packet, you'll notice that it's pretty straightforward. It's a one-pager, not a whole lot to look through here. What it does is it sets the salary of the Executive Secretary of the Board at a range 23. Some of you may remember the accounting bill that the legislature passed unanimously last session. It created the position of Executive Secretary on the Board of Public Accountancy. And the creation of the position was very widely supported both in the building and statewide because of the wide recognition that the all-volunteer Board of Public Accountancy was simply understaffed and struggling to fulfill its mission. And since the board's mission necessarily involves the protection of the public interest, for those of you unfamiliar, the board has jurisdiction over all CPAs practicing in the state, and so it can exercise its jurisdiction and it can address violations of its standards in the state. So because the board serves the public interest in this way, there was massive support for the creation of this position to help alleviate the staffing problems on the board, and because obviously everyone wants the board to be able to protect our public interest. The only problem is that after the position was created by the bill, the department administration, as it does in these instances, came out with their salary draft determination for the position, and they placed this position at a range 19. Range 19, we feel, will not attract a qualified candidate to the position, and thus the board will be back kind of in the same position as we were last year, lacking a qualified executive or a qualified administrator with the necessary expertise to help the board fulfill its functions. The bill that passed last year that called for this position to be created, that created this executive secretary, it called for the position to be at a range 23. The fiscal note of the bill called for the position to be at a range of 23. And we heard from CPAs all throughout the state, along with the State Board of Public Accountancy and the Alaska Society of CPAs, and everyone supported this position at a range of 23. And I think it's particularly important to note that the Alaska Society of CPAs supported this at a range 23 because that's the organization representing all of the CPAs in the state. And who's going to pay the salary of this executive secretary? The CPAs in the state. This salary comes from their licensing fees. So the state of Alaska is not paying this. This comes from the CPAs. And they're all supporting this at a range of 23. So obviously their support is vital, and it signals a recognition from those within the industry that range 23 is the appropriate rate for someone at that position. So everyone we've been hearing from in the accounting profession has agreed that a range 19 is just not sufficient, and they say that for a number of reasons. And the first is that the body of professional knowledge used by CPAs, it's vast, it's technical, and it's comprehensive. The professional standards and the enforcement cases that that the executive secretary is going to be dealing with, they can be complex, and it requires staff with a significant level of expertise and professional knowledge and experience. The executive secretary will be the Alaska representative to the National Association of the Boards of Public Accountancy, and that's an organization that significantly directs and makes changes to accountancy enforcement standards and proposed revisions to statutes and regulations in the whole United States. And it's a very active board, and so it's critical that the Alaska board have good representation to the National Association of Board of Public Accountancy so that our interests can be expressed to this national board. And so we simply must be able to attract a person with the requisite experience and credentials to engage with the National Association of Boards of Public Accountancy. And a range 23 position will allow us to do that. It'll allow us to attract this type of person, and a range 19 won't. And just to give you an idea, a range 19 is approximately $58,000 a year. And in an environment where an unlicensed grad fresh out of college with zero experience, they can easily pull in $60,000 a year straight out of school with no license. So it's kind of easy to see why a $58,000 a year job won't exactly be enticing to someone with the level of expertise and experience that the Board of Public Accountancy needs. And I should note also that kind of key to the recruitment and retention of the executive secretary with these skills is the fact that the executive secretaries nationwide are generally paid significantly higher than our range 19. So the fact that the Department of Administration did not consider these market forces in making the determination is going to greatly limit the board's ability to attract and retain an executive secretary with the appropriate skills. So as you can see, this bill kind of could be seen as a legislative fix for the discrepancy between the pay ranges here. The Board of Public Accountancy, the Alaska Society of CPAs, and all the accountants who we've heard from all support this legislation. We've heard of no opposition to it. And indeed, the Department of Administration has signaled their willingness to work with the legislature here in whatever the legislature decides is the appropriate pay range here. Mr. Chairman, on the line, I have two individuals, both CPAs, and they can speak in great detail about the work of the board and the their need, really, for an appropriately compensated executive secretary and all the public outreach that they have done that has led them to think that a range 23 is the appropriate range. So I'd just like to point that out and close my introduction to the bill here. And
I see at least one question for you.
All right.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Jennifer. That was helpful. You laid out for us what the base salary is, you know, at a step A for a range 19. Can you tell us what the base salary at a step A would be for a range 23?
You know, I do not have that information in front of me, but I know we have folks from the Department of Administration here, and they may be able to help with that.
We'll get to them in a few minutes. Any further questions for Jennifer? I might add this bill was by request from the Department of Administration, so I believe they're extremely supportive since they asked for it. I didn't bother asking anybody from DOA to be here, but we do have in the room Nikki Neal for questions and Don Habinger from occupational license, business licensing for questions too, if we need them. But if not, we will go to Don Brulian from Anchorage, the representing the Alaska Society of CPAs. I believe that was probably one of your two people.
Yes, I'm here. This is Don Brulian.
And can you state your affiliation, please, Don, for the record?
I'm here to testify on behalf of the Alaska Society of CPAs.
Please continue.
We feel that HB 147 is important to our profession. We feel the professional knowledge needed in regards to our professional standards is both technical and very comprehensive. And our professional standards for CPAs cover not only the audit arena, the state and federal income tax arena, but also many all of our ethical standards that we have to follow. the enforcement can be very complex due to all these complex standards that we're required to follow, and therefore it is imperative that the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy not be further hampered by an inexperienced executive secretary. So therefore, we think HB 147 would be a very important bill to pass.
And again, you're picking up the tab for this position.
Yes, we are. The CPAs in the state of Alaska pay, through their dues, pay for all these costs.
Any questions for Don? Representative Sadler.
Yes, Mr. Rillian, through the chair. Do you have anybody in mind as a candidate for this job at Range 23?
I don't know of that right now. I think if Max Mertz is on the line or he will testify, he may have a better knowledge of that.
Okay. I would just certainly would encourage you to look within Alaska. That's a good paying job, and it deserves to stay at home.
We'd love to have somebody from Alaska. We'd love to have somebody that had been some public accounting experience would even be better. But as was mentioned earlier, somebody coming out of college now in accounting, you know, before they're even certified, can get up to $60,000 a year. It's a very tight market out there right now for accounting professionals and for any kind of professionals.
Representative Thompson.
Yes. Have you been having a problem keeping this position manned at the rate that it's at? I mean, have you had a big turnover of personnel?
We've had a tremendous amount of turnover, and we used to share the administrator with other boards, and then the executive secretaries we have been getting have been a great deal of turnover, and the training time is going to be extensive for them to kind of understand what's going on and try to learn the standards and the rules we have to follow before they can really, you know, become an important player, important member of the Alaska State Board.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody can check my math, but I looked up the answer to my own question. And it looks like at a Step A, Range 19 would be $59,196 a year, and a Range 23 would be $77,100 a year. And people are free to check my math, because I had to take the monthly salary and multiply them by 12. So monthly, but the monthly salary for Range 19 is $4,933 at a Step A, and a Range 23 Step A is $6,425 a month.
I trust your
so
mind.
That we know what we're. It's always good to kind of have an idea of what we're doing.
You're trying to get her CPA license.
Yeah. Trying to stay off.
Well, thanks again, Don. Max, are you online by chance? Or in the room?
Nope.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Is there anybody online? With that, we'll close out public testimony. What are the wishes of the committee?
Go ahead.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 147-27-LS0511-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, this one will also move on to finance before it gets to the floor, which brings us to another brief at ease. On the record, next item on the agenda today is House Bill 155, public construction contracts. I won't say it's a simple little bill, but I think it's a long overdue bill. But Jennifer Sinnett from my office will be bringing us up to speed on it. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, good afternoon to the committee. Jennifer Sinnett, staff, to the chair, Representative Olson. As the chair said, we have in front of you HB 155, an act relating to public construction contracts. Basically, this bill does two things. The first thing that it does is it raises the trigger point at which public construction projects have to meet before they qualify for prevailing wages. Currently, the threshold sits at $2,000, and this legislation would raise that to $75,000. And the second thing that this legislation does is it establishes a boundary between maintenance, which would not be subject to Little Davis-Bacon wages in public construction, which would be subject to Little Davis Bacon. So getting kind of to the first point, just focus on that for a second, the increase of the dollar threshold from $2,000 to $75,000. You'll see that in Section 1 of the bill. And just a small bit of background just so we can differentiate between the Federal Davis-Bacon Act and the Little Davis-Bacon Act. I'm sure you're all aware that during the Great Depression, Congress enacted a federal statute, the Davis-Bacon Act, that prescribed minimum wages, prevailing wages, to be paid to construction workers on federal public works contracts. Subsequently, state legislatures enacted their own similar laws, and those are known as Little Davis-Bacon Acts. And as I'm speaking here today, I may refer to those as LDBA, just make it a little easier. So Alaska's Little Davis-Bacon Act is found in Title 36, and that law applies to public construction contracts over $2,000. Alaska's $2,000 limit was modeled after the limit of the Federal Davis-Bacon Act. And again, I'll emphasize that was set during the Great Depression. That was set in 1935. So the reason that there is a threshold at all is because of the realization that some projects are just simply too small to justify the substantial administrative burden associated with Little Davis-Bacon compliance. Because right now, if your project is under $2,000, it can be completed without jumping through all the administrative hoops that LDBA requires. That's certified payroll, that's reporting requirements, that's filing with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It's a substantial administrative burden. But if you go over $2,000, that administrative burden is now yours to deal with. And the problem is that in Alaska, and especially in rural Alaska, it's hard to find a public construction project that doesn't go over $2,000. The federal $2,000 limit was based on a workforce that was very mobile, and the communities that these projects were being done in were easily accessible. And I think we all know that in Alaska, sometimes that's just not the case. Many of our communities are only accessible by air or by barge. And so clearly that fact makes it difficult for any project being undertaken out in rural Alaska to fit under the current threshold, because by the time you've transported all your materials out there and by the time you've taken into account all of the logistical factors associated with doing construction in Alaska, by the time you take that all into account, you're probably going to be well beyond $2,000. So even if you really do have a genuinely small construction project, by virtue of being an Alaska construction project, you're probably not going to fall below the $2,000 limit. So in practice, basically, having such a low threshold here is the functional equivalent, I'd say, of there being no threshold at all. So raising the threshold, it can also be seen as an economic development issue as well, because the rigidity of LDBA compliance requirements, it often discourages smaller firms from submitting bids. In rural areas, it often means that workers need to be imported into these areas from around the state to do a job that may have been able to be done locally, but due to the rigidity of the LDBA requirements, it just wasn't bid on by local firms. So increasing the threshold amount would serve to open the opportunity up to smaller contractors, contractors who might not otherwise have had the experience or the wherewithal to deal with LDBA compliance. But now, since the threshold is higher, now they can enter the market for these small-scale construction projects. I should note that a number of other states have increased their thresholds. Alaska would hardly be breaking any new ground here. 19 states have thresholds that are much higher than the $2,000 floor we have now. The average threshold in these states is $108,000. And I believe in your packets you have a list from the Department of Labor, and it lists all 50 states and their respective thresholds, so you might find that helpful. One final thing on the subject of just the increased threshold is, again, just noting that that threshold was based on the federal threshold in the Davis-Bacon Act, and again, set in 1935. So the inflationary pressures alone of the last 75 years would certainly justify an increased trigger point, because needless to say, a lot changes in 75 years. And combine that with the Alaska-specific factors that I mentioned, and we think an increase to the $2,000 limit is a pretty reasonable proposal. On to the second point of the legislation, the marking boundary between maintenance and construction work. This bill attempts to exclude maintenance contracts from the definition of public construction, and thus it would exclude maintenance projects from having to comply with LDBA. current statute kind of broadly defines public construction. It's not very clear what projects are considered construction and what projects are considered maintenance. So the language in Section 8 of the bill, you'll see, helps to clarify that. And this bill places maintenance outside of LDBA because, really, I mean, there's a huge difference between maintenance and construction. You think about the filling of 15 potholes out somewhere in rural Alaska or the replacement of guardrails along the side of the road. Those jobs should not be subject to Little Davis-Bacon wages. That's maintenance. That is not construction. So that's kind of the rationale there between separating those out. So that, Mr. Chairman, that's a brief summary of the bill. I think if you look through your packets, moving on to the fiscal note, you'll see it's a $396,000 decrement, and that decrement is associated with filing fees. And then also you'll note support from various organizations around the state. A lot of the municipalities are heavily behind this, and we've been hearing lots of support from them. So that's a basic introduction. I know that this bill has generated a lot of public comment, and I think probably a lot of the folks on the committee have been hearing from constituents about it. So I kind of understand I was just here to give a overview and as
any
you wish.
Questions for Jennifer before I jump in?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well presented, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any particular reason? Do we have any justification why we would jump from the current $2,000 threshold to $75,000? Is this just inflation, something else?
Representative Miller, through the chair, inflation obviously accounts for a large chunk of that. The original conversation that we have had when municipalities have started coming to us and talking to us about this, I believe it was in the, I think it was up at $250,000. That's a rather large jump. Probably rather start a little bit lower than that, make it a little more manageable. So that's kind of where we started, and we ended at 75.
For any particular reason?
I think I can answer that.
Fine. I'll redirect.
I guess sponsor of the bill.
Yes, sir.
That number was pulled out of the air. It was
that's a different location.
It's not as high as the average increase of the other states, but for this bill to pass, it's going to be a collaborative effort amongst the public entities, the unions, the legislature. Ultimately, I think it's probably going to be a little lower than what it is right now. We're going to be entertaining some amendments on Monday that are a work in progress. They're cleaning up some of the languages, addressing the limit, which I would suspect by Monday will probably be $50,000, which is slightly above the inflation level and slightly less than the national average. But realistically, for this bill to pass, it's going to have to be palatable to a number of people. And I think for that reason, I think that we will start out at a reasonable number. Does that help?
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you.
Representative Hadley.
Not quite sure who to direct this to, but Mr. Chair, through the chair, possibly. Could someone explain to me the difference between rehabilitation work, which would be covered under this, on line 3 at the bottom, page 3, line 29, and maintenance? What's the difference between rehabilitation and maintenance?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I should have pointed out we have some folks from the Department of Labor here, and I believe they may be able to address that question. If anyone wants to step up.
Let's see. I believe we've got Mr. Mitchell.
And Mr. Chairman, while he's at it, he could maybe separate out what repair is also different from maintenance.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking us off the hook.
My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division with Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The question, as I understand it, is what's the difference between rehabilitation work and maintenance work? And right now, the department is operating off of an attorney general opinion that was issued in 1982 that draws a distinction between repair work, which is subject to the Little Davis-Bacon Act, and maintenance work, which is not subject to the Little Davis-Bacon Act. By determining whether or not new material is needed for the project. So if you can, you know, resurface the material, grade it, you know, clean out the potholes with what's there, then that's all maintenance. It's not subject to the Little Davis-Bacon Act requirements now. If you did start to change things, bring in new materials, you know, truckloads of dirt or new guardrail material, that type of thing, then that would fall into what is considered construction work rather than repair work. I'm sorry, repair work rather than maintenance work.
Representative Holmes?
Wow, that just really messed me up.
Yeah,
because now this definition I've got here of maintenance work doesn't bear any. First of all, I'd love to get that Attorney General's opinion if we could get that to the committee. But second of all, the definition we got here of maintenance work on the top of page 4 bears no resemblance to what you just said. So now I don't know in this bill what rehabilitation or repair would mean that would be subject to it versus what maintenance work is here, which doesn't seem to talk at all about using existing materials that are on site only. If that's what we're trying to exclude, then the language here doesn't get us there as far as I can tell.
Sorry.
Was that a question?
That was a question. Yeah, to help.
Yeah. that would be an accurate statement. The language that's currently in the bill doesn't match with what, you know, the department's interpretations have been over time about what constitutes repair work versus what constitutes maintenance work.
And I might add that's one of the kinks we're working our way through.
And Mr. Chairman, as we're working our way through this kink, might I suggest that we figure out, you know, what not only what is maintenance, but also what is rehabilitation, what is repair. I mean, these seem to be overlapping concepts, and unless we've got definitions of them, having some on one side and some on the other, I think you're going to get us all wrapped around the axle pretty. We could spend a lot of time in committee on that.
And that's why we're
that's why I'm phrasing it the way I am, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. I look forward to working that out.
Representative Sadler, you kind of took you out of rotation there for a minute.
Sorry.
The question is there being in the process of being answered. So I'll stand by for the answer. Okay.
Can I ask?
Go for it.
Other one.
Follow-up, new question.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, I'm not exactly sure who this is a question for. This might be a question back to the sponsor again. The issue of the school districts and regional educational attendance areas being added, being accepted from the from coverage, is that?
That was one of the first things that was we discovered needed a little bit of clarification.
In other words, that's going to be something that we're going to be clarifying moving forward.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to get that on the record.
Mr. Miller.
That was the same question.
Oh, okay. I'm just telepathic, aren't I?
Yeah. See there?
Okay.
Any further questions for the Department of Labor at this point in time? I've got a feeling you'll be in the room for another half hour or so.
Yes.
Thanks again.
Actually, can I ask one more question before he runs too far away?
Representative Holmes.
Does the department have a position on this bill?
At this point, the department's neutral.
At this point in time, we are much further than, actually, the meeting is a lot further along than I thought, but we do have people online that are willing to testify on this that have had a direct impact on it. I think I may be opening it up to public discussion, which I didn't think we were going to have a chance to get to today, but we do have people online, and I think I'm going to start out with Ron Kovalik, Fairbanks. Did I butcher your name wrong, Ron?
Ron
Kovalik. Tim Beck, Fairbanks. Have we lost Fairbanks? That was easy. Huh. Gary Knopp.
I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation, Gary. I know who you are, but nobody else does. And you've got our undivided attention. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, sir. Gary Knopp, I am the current president of the Kenai-Pensacola Borough Assembly, and I want to thank all the committee in its entirety for hearing this, and especially to Representative Olson for bringing this forward. As he stated earlier, I believe it's much past due. It's somewhat difficult to add to this as the sponsor statement and the staff did such an excellent job in laying out the issues. But I would like to mention in the sponsor statement, line 3 of the second paragraph, where he states that House Bill 155 updates this antiquated statute. That's really what this bill is about, is updating antiquated legislation that's seriously eroding the purchasing dollar of local communities and local taxpayer dollars. And I would also like to just speak briefly, as Ms. Sinnett did, to paragraph 4. Application exists to the wide recognition that some projects are simply too small to justify the overhead associated with complying with LDBA. You know, and it drives a lot of contractors away from participation in this. So the sponsor statement's very accurate and does a great job at that avenue of things. Let's see here. Also, I'd like to also reiterate what Jennifer Sinnett said in her statement is the fact that all these dollars we're talking about are state and local taxpayer dollars. These are not federal dollars. So any affiliation with federal funding for construction projects is still subject to the federal Davis-Bacon Act or $2,000. And I wanted to make sure we differentiate between that, because a lot of our revenue comes from service areas that have very small revenue streams, and when we're forced to pay a prevailing wage rate on a project as simple as patching potholes or pulling gravel back into ditches, which we view as a maintenance item, and having to pay these rates is extremely detrimental to the borough. The other thing that she mentioned was the definition between maintenance and construction, and one of the committee members made a great distinction, or actually one committee member, Mr. Mitchell, about maintenance and repair. They're almost one and the same. You know, currently the Department of Labor, because it is so broadly defined in statute, somewhat interprets everything in excess of $2,000 to be construction. That has been our experience with the Department of Labor in pretty much all of our projects. And the question raised between maintenance and repair shouldn't be so much the issue of whether they're using new materials or not. The issue is the value of the project. If it's less than $75,000, does it warrant all the other criteria that goes with that? So, and it may require some language change, as was mentioned, but I would hope you guys would consider that as well. I want to speak briefly to the amendments that are going to be proposed. You'll speak with on Monday, I believe.
You're going to be calling in again on Monday, since we don't have the amendments before us today.
Oh, well, I won't speak to them today, and I'll try it here on Monday then.
Yeah.
Okay. I do want to speak to the fiscal note, the analysis of the fiscal note. If you look at this fiscal note, as you may or may not be aware, all projects up to $25,000 today does not require a filing fee. So the filing fee of 1% does not kick in until you reach the $25,000 threshold. And that number for the public construction projects don't list the number from $1 to $25,000. It'd be nice to pull that out of there, look at the impact from $25,000 to $75,000. Also, if you look at the number, 1,413 public construction projects had a contract value less than $75,000. That's just about 70% of all your entire projects. You can just about imagine the amount of workload it would relieve on the Department of Labor. So I actually view it as on the fiscal note, as considerable savings to the state in that aspect of things. So it would be... it would be something else. The other issue I was going to speak of relates to the schools and the amendments, but I think I will save that for Monday as well, so you'll have that in front of you. I do want to make a quick reference to a legislative audit report that was done in 2000. Audit report 05-4605 was done for the Department of Labor, Workforce Development, and Department of Education Early Development to see how well they were complying with the reporting. And in that, on page 12 of that report, at the top of that page, it suggests a deluge of certified payrolls up to 4,000 a week negates any systematic screening by Department of Labor Workforce Development. So although you may only have 2,200 public construction projects in a year's time, if Department of Labor is being bombarded with certified payrolls, that, again, is a drastically reduced workload for the Department of Labor. And this 2000 legislative audit report, at that time, 12 years ago, recommended a shift to $25,000. And they also, I think, made a distinction to define maintenance versus construction in this report as well. And I'll switch hats here just briefly. In my other life, I wear a contractor's hat. I do a little road work, dirt work, and I got to say that on the fiscal side of things, where I can pay a truck driver equipment operator $25 an hour, and it costs me about an additional 32 to 35% to employ him due to unemployment insurance, workman's comp, general liabilities. When I put that same employee on a prevailing wage rate job, he cost me just about $86 or $87 an hour. His wage goes from $25 to about $47. And then because my insurance premiums are based on payroll, my workman's comp, general liability, and everything associated with that goes up. So they actually cost me almost 100% more for that same type of job. And so I wanted you to understand the cost differences to contractors. In the fiscal note, you talked about, in the analysis back to that one.
Gary,
Yes.
We have six more people online that I'd like to be able to get through today. Can you wrap it up, please?
I can in 15 seconds.
Thanks.
Thank you. Fiscal note, $152,000 associated with them filing fees. The $152,000 actually belongs to contractors and local taxpayers, so it may not be much at the state level, but it's pretty significant at the local taxpayer level, so I'd hope you consider that as well, and I think I'll end my comments there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. Mark Fowler, are you with us?
I am. Thank you. I know we're short on time, so I'll try to keep it brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Fowler. I'm the purchasing and contracting officer here with the Kenai Peninsula Borough. First off, Mayor Carey was unable to attend. However, he has provided a letter of support, which we've submitted here for written testimony. I believe a copy of that will be provided to you. So with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today regarding the House Bill 155. The borough would certainly like to show its support for this bill. We believe it will not only benefit the borough by allowing for more buying power for the taxpayer's dollar, but also benefit the smaller, more localized contractor by encouraging them to participate in the smaller, less complex projects. As most of you are probably aware, the borough is approximately 25,000 square miles with many communities and villages spread throughout. And in these communities, there are many small contractors. In our remote communities, the borough frequently encounters a small, limited pool of contractors. Albeit it may be a limited marketplace, these contractors are oftentimes very capable of meeting the borough's needs as it applies to the smaller, less complex projects. What we're finding is the smaller, more localized contractors are less and less willing to participate in the project if it's subject to the Little Davis-Bacon Act. This in turn drives the cost of doing business and also fails to generate any local work for the contractors. I'd like to give you an example, if I could. Recently, in a remote community, we recently identified a need for fencing at a borough facility. A local contractor quoted approximately $7,500 to complete the work. It exceeded the $2,000 threshold established by the Little Davis-Bacon Act. Therefore, we informed the contractor that the fencing project would be subject to Davis-Bacon rates. The contractor informed us that he was no longer interested in providing the service due to the administrative burden. The borough then paid in excess of $18,000 for a non-local contractor to mob up with his labor force, fly into the community to perform the work. The same scope of work that was quoted for $7,500. Again, oftentimes these communities are logistically challenged, which significantly impacts the cost of doing business. There are many examples of smaller, less complex projects that have been negatively impacted due to the low threshold. The smaller, less complex projects that are subject to the Little Davis-Bacon Act are very administratively burdensome on the borough, the contractor, and most certainly on the Department of Labor. I cannot imagine the number of small projects the Department of Labor receives notice on every week. So as I previously stated, we at the borough believe this bill will benefit the residents of the Kenai Peninsula Borough as well as the contractors themselves. If I have time, I'd like to make a quick comment regarding the fiscal note. Do we have time for that, Mr. Chair?
You do.
Thank you. With regards to the fiscal note, Mr. Knopf also made reference to that, but I'd like to expand on it if I could. Currently, Department of Labor does not receive a filing fee for those projects less than $25,000. However, the Department of Labor must process the projects, all projects, between $2,000 and up. So the projects between the $2,000 and the $25,000, the Department of Labor does not receive any type of filing fee. However, these projects still require a significant amount of administrative effort without any compensation to the Department of Labor. If the threshold is increased to $75,000, the Department of Labor will receive filing fee on all projects that they process. And with that, again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill.
We take a question, Mark?
Sure.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fowler, we've got, in my way of thinking, sort of three things that as a committee we're going to be puzzling over with this bill. The first is one that's been talked about a lot, which is the changing of the $2,000 threshold. The other two questions, though, are the question about whether or not we're going to basically change the definitions to exclude a lot more maintenance work, and the third one is whether or not school districts and regional educational attendance area projects will be exempted. It sounds like your comments were mostly on the monetary threshold. Is that your primary interest in this bill, is seeing the monetary threshold raised from $2,000 as opposed to the seeing maintenance exempted or seeing school districts and regional educational attendance areas exempted?
Through the chair, Ms. Holmes, the borough actually, we support the bill in its in its entirety. I spoke specifically to what I personally have the most experience dealing with here at the borough. I believe there may be other testimonies today that that address some of your some of those other issues.
Okay.
Does that help?
Sure. I'll look forward to hearing the answers from other people too.
Thanks again, Mark. Scott Bloom, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Scott Bloom, and I am the Assistant Kenai Peninsula Borough Attorney. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 155. In my capacity as Assistant Borough Attorney, I provide legal guidance for the Borough's Capital Projects Department, Road Service Area, and Maintenance Department, as well as other areas of borough government. The Little Davis-Bacon Act, as currently written, is unduly burdensome on our municipalities' public construction and maintenance activities and lacks the clarity required to allow the borough to accurately determine which projects are subject to the Act and which are not. What I'd like to focus on is why the language must be changed to better define public construction from maintenance activities, as is proposed in Section 8 of the bill. The proposed language is a departure from the current framework, a framework which I would argue does not work. It's based on a 1982 Attorney General opinion, and there's little, if any, Alaska case law that lends any help to better defining maintenance from construction. The borough's road service area contracts out the maintenance of its borough roads. These activities include plowing and grading roads, maintaining ditches, brushing, replacing culverts, calcium chloride application, and fixing potholes and sinkholes. Additionally, these contractors would replace lost gravel and travel surfaces. The road service area also has a capital improvement program to upgrade roads, and we clearly understand that these capital improvement projects are subject to LBB, but often other activities are much less clear. Is brushing considered to be a public construction as rehabilitation under the Act? What if the new brush line exceeds the prior brush line? Is pulling the gravel from the ditches back onto the roadway subject to the Act as rehabilitation or repair? What if the activity makes the ditch a little wider or deeper than it previously was? What if new materials are added to the ditches? Is applying calcium chloride akin to painting? And does the Act require this activity to have Davis-Bacon rates apply? If we saw a culvert, is that subject to the Act as a repair? If we replace lost gravel on a roadway, fill a pothole or sinkhole, are these activities rehabilitation and or repair? If we put $1,500 of gravel on a road one day and a week later we put $600 of gravel on a nearby road, do these activities constitute one LDB project over $2,000? Our maintenance projects are generally relatively small in value, not exceeding $20,000. Approving a higher ceiling on the LDB projects and approving the proposed language in Section 8 of the bill, which better distinguishes maintenance from public construction, would alleviate much of the borough's struggle in determining whether a project falls under LDB or not. It is critically important for the borough to know whether a project falls under LDB for compliance reasons and others. LDB projects take longer to process and complete, and often our needs arise very quickly. LDB projects also limit our pool of available contractors, and finally, LDB projects cost more. The bottom line is that the greater number of projects that fall under the Act, the less projects the borough can complete and the less services it can provide to the taxpayers of the borough. I also like to have one comment on the fiscal note regarding the villages that have been taken out. I would recommend that Section 8, subsection 4, be changed to reflect the language in AF 3695.010 subsection 6 with the addition of exclusionary language for the school districts. Thank you.
Will you take a question?
Certainly.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bloom, that was you were sort of reading my mind, I guess, on the my question to the prior speaker. And you actually helped me understand the issue around what is and isn't included. And I'm looking forward to seeing this 1982 Attorney General opinion at some point. But I guess my question for you is, looking at Section 8, the subsection 2 part that defines public construction, I'm not sure that really helps get us any more clarity. We've got rehabilitation and repair included, but we have maintenance excluded, and I can't really tell what's what. So do you read this? Do you agree with us that maybe we need some work on this section of figuring out what's in and out? Because I don't know that the definition we've got in front of us actually is any clearer than maybe less clear.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I do agree that a definition is problematic. I don't know that a perfect solution can be reached. What I think the definition that is proposed in Section 8 does is, while it doesn't necessarily tell us what rehabilitation, repair is, it tells us what it's not. And we know that what rehabilitation and repair is not maintenance as defined. And I think that's more than what we've ever had. I think the current framework in which, you know, whether material is brought to a site or is not brought to the site is problematic. I think it's only an attorney general opinion that's followed by DOL, but it's beyond that, it doesn't have a whole lot of legal consequence. And unless it's changed, it's probably something that would be determined by a court at a later date, which I don't think is the best route to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Mr. Bloom. Robert Ruffner, you still with us?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Ruffner, and for the record, I'm the executive director of the Kenai Watershed Forum. We're a smaller, medium-sized nonprofit that does work surrounding habitat and streams across the entire Kenai Peninsula. So we have a pretty large area to cover, and exposure to LDBA has come over the years. We've done a fair amount of road work and have learned a little bit by trial and error where we bump into this. And a lot of the work that we do is clearly public construction and clearly falls squarely within this act and probably should be. But some of the work that we do falls outside of it, and probably because we've had exposure to the act with our road work, we've found ourselves in some challenging situations where we would really like to see some clarity in the language that we've talked about here just in the last two speakers. So we'd be very supportive of working on that language, and specifically nonprofit organizations, you know, typically are doing something for the public good, and they often have relationships with the local government. And oftentimes they have relationships with sponsors and people that want to help see some good project come to fruition. One of the limitations that we have is when someone that wants to make a donation or volunteer their time or spend some form of energy helping on a project that has been deemed public construction winds up being subject to this act and really limits our ability to get a project done that is in the best interest of the local government and the folks that want to volunteer their time or spend some money to help make it happen. So when we mix local government dollars in with private sector dollars, it gets confusing. So the language that we have here where we're increasing the threshold at which LDBA kicks in would definitely be a help for us, and we'd be very supportive of that. The additional thing that I would like to see some discussion or kick this around a little bit is to see if there's not an opportunity for, and I'll just call them these do-gooder projects, to have an opportunity to have some exemptions listed in the act as well. I think that would be very beneficial, and people in the local government would see a better result for some of the things that have been deemed public construction. And those are trails, parks, fences, some road work, I mean, all of those things, buildings that are shared between a local government and a nonprofit, you know, when they need to get work done, those all fall in the category of public construction as I understand it. So those types of things, you know, again, for the nonprofit sector, it would be very beneficial to have them looked at in addition to just raising the ceiling, which would also help. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak.
Oh, thanks again, Robert, and please rest assured that everybody in this room wants language to be clear. We don't want this thing to be fought out for the next 5 years in court. You know, it's only going to be effective if we can get it right on the first go-around. But thanks again. Ron Kovalik, Fairbanks?
Yes, sir. Ron Kovalik here with two other people in Fairbanks. I've been a volunteer road commissioner for over 30 years. 2 years ago, this was dropped on us like a bomb, and it just about paralyzed us. I'm all in favor of the $75,000 limit, and I'd like to see that indexed to inflation. If we start talking about maintenance, rehabilitation, and repair, we're going to go around in circles and put lawyers to work. It's not going to fix any roads. We need to forget about those things. What the road needs, we do. It takes gravel, we use gravel. If we need machinery, we use machinery. And they've made it real hard for our volunteers to come out and knock down a little brush, push a little snow. They've acted like that's a crime against nature. That's got to stop. It just practically paralyzes us and prevents us from getting any work done.
Ron, I've got a question for you, and I kind of know the answer, but I doubt if most of the people in the room do. How many road service areas do you have in the Fairbanks area?
Over 100.
That's what I thought. That's down from 130 and 140, I think, isn't it? I believe as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, almost 140. So you've got a lot of small projects that would be impacted by this, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and it seems to be driving off the volunteers.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to participate, and I think Tim Beck is probably there with you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Chairman Olson and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I'm a past Road Service Area Commissioner, currently a member of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly and the Assembly Road Service Area Committee, but today I'm speaking as a member of the Alaska Municipal League Board. Many folks may not realize Fairbanks North Star Borough does not have road powers. Only those that are established by road service areas, represented by a commission of local residents from within the road service areas. The $2,000 threshold is easily surpassed in your larger service areas, and often regular maintenance has to be addressed as a capital project due to this $2,000 limit, increasing both the cost and the time to completion. This increase is long overdue and will save local residents thousands of dollars by avoiding the administrative and design costs associated with capital projects. The two things that I see coming out of this that is advantageous to us locally here is changing the $2,000 threshold to a more practical figure would put more gravel on the road rather than create more paperwork for road service area commissioners. The second thing is the definitions must be clearly defined between capital improvements and maintenance. Now, maintenance to me, and this is my own opinion, is to bring a road back to its existing condition prior to an event such as snow plowing or erosion by flooding, even if it includes additional material to do so. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak. And also, we currently have 107 road service areas.
Thanks again, Tim, but I heard we had possibly one more person in Fairbanks that wanted to testify.
I believe he's not signed up, and he's said he sent an email earlier today.
Oh, okay. Perfect, then. Thanks again for sticking with us. Mitchell Ratcher from Homer.
Hi.
Was I close on your last name?
Mitchell Rockyar. Thanks for having me to testify here. Keep in mind when you...
Can you state your affiliation, please?
I'm representing myself. Please keep in mind when you lower the threshold on bonds and bids and payment bonds and et cetera, the owner is taking a bigger risk on getting that job done and employees getting paid. There's going to be some creative work done here by the contract administrators. Also, when you have a 150,000 K project, it's going to be split up into two smaller projects. So you're going to have more contract management on that area. And say, for instance, I was bidding a project, and another fellow mentioned he was a contractor also. When you do away with wages, you're opening it up to a different wage scale. The Bacon wages that are established is everybody's on equal parity. Say, for instance, you have three contractors. One bids it at $30 an hour for labor. One bids it at $25 an hour, and the other bids it at $15 an hour. The fella that bids it at $30 an hour is not going to get the job. When I could go out to and pick guys up off the street for $15 an hour, that contractor with bigger payments and bigger equipment is going to lose out because I could do the job for half the price. And then you're really opening up to labor and lowering of the middle class and a working wage for people. The Bacon wages are established to keep a good middle class working with good benefits. There's nothing to say that I hire a guy for $15 an hour, I do the workers' comp, I pay for his insurance, cost me $20-$25 an hour. So just keep in mind when you're changing the wage scale, you're opening up to a lot of low bidders. Is there any questions I could field?
No, but thank you again for bearing with us.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else online? I'm not going to close out public testimony. I saw a look over there, but Again, this bill will be back for us next week, as will...
one more from Kenai.
Oh, one more from Kenai. Who did we miss?
No,
he's done. Okay. Nope, but that, we'll be hearing 118. Not enough time to do anything with 118 today. That'll be back up next week, and with that, we'll adjourn at 4:48, something like that.